is the same objective you had when you passed the downtown ordinances. Your objective is to remove a class of people from the downtown area. That is something the Santa Cruz community should never permit. If you want to give a call and join this rather extended reading of today's Santa Cruz Sentinel with Bathrobes Pierre Robert, that's me, give a call to 427-3772, 427-FRSC, and you will join this dialogue. And it's an important one. Forrest asked why cities like Las Gatas and Capitola don't have similar problems. Kennedy, however, noted that no matter what the police department does, Santa Cruz always will have a diversity that includes these kinds of wanderers. Here's Kennedy playing to the left again. He's got these two faces that are just so predictable. Definitely, here is a different climate. This is a different climate here, said Kennedy. This is not Omaha, this is not Capitola, and we don't want it to be. We just want more police, more private security guards, and more Parks and Rec rangers on horseback. Thank you, Squawk Box Scott Kennedy, killer of the campground, and apparently, in spite of your statements, champion of keeping the sleeping ban the way it is. Scott Kennedy has frequently said he opposes the sleeping ban when he shows up at demonstrations to kind of lure the media in his direction. But when it comes to the city council, we see nothing from Kennedy about changing the sleeping ban. We see no public statements. We see no leadership. I'm afraid that Mr. Kennedy's behavior speaks for itself. Turning again to Ford's parking lot, a couple of days ago I was rushing around looking for Tim Rinker, a homeless person who's a regular at the sleepout. I call him Token Tim for obvious reasons. And he's a man who's been using the armory, who is now regularly employed, but has to hide out and sleep because he has no legal place to sleep. While I was looking for him, I ran into reports of police abuse at the Ford's parking lot. And this is the real story, folks, the abuse of poor people in that area. This is the story the Sentinel does not cover and will never cover. This is the story that Free Radio Santa Cruz covers and that you have to cover. You have to be on your guard. You have to be alert. You have to keep your eyes open. You have to set aside extra time when you go downtown to witness, record, watch, and support those who are being harassed by the police in that area. Theft of backpacks from poor people is not appropriate. It was done in mass down in Santa Ana, and homeless people with Legal Aid Society's assistance were able to sue and get that practice stopped and get, to some extent, stalled, and I guess stopped, and actually to get the sleeping ban down there lifted for a while until the California Supreme Court ruled in with a tricky decision last year. Our Legal Aid Society has been unwilling to do anything of the kind, just like our ACLU has taken no cases under the sleeping ban. We've been urging them to do so, but they hold their secret meetings, they hold their private meetings, and they don't invite us. And when we find our way into their meetings through hook or by crook, they ignore us. And they ignore those who quite reasonably bring up presentations that the sleeping ban should be challenged by a group like the American Civil Liberties Union, or like a group like the Legal Aid Society, which is supposed to be concerned with the rights of poor people and defending the rights of poor people. As I said, in Southern California, Harry Simon of the Legal Aid Society did effectively challenge these practices of stealing people's backpacks, herding them around, illegally searching what they're doing, searching their possessions and stealing their possessions. And those practices were enjoined by the courts, as they were enjoined in Miami. In fact, the practice of arresting people for sleeping was enjoined in the Pottinger decision in Miami some years ago, though there's been some recent changes in that decision which haven't yet quite reached me. And if anybody wants to do some research on them, give a call to me at 423-HUFF. I'd love to have some help on that. But what we have downtown is we have an Alice in Wonderland inversion of the real situation in the Sentinel, which is nothing new. The Sentinel always screams about the poor people and the hippies and the people who have a lifestyle that they don't like. But we also have the city council turning matters on their head, turning truth upside down. What we need is an investigation of police abuse, and you can actually aid in that investigation. If you're listening to this show, not only should you be out there on the streets doing your own cop watch, and that can happen at any time of the day. Just give yourself a little extra time to watch and help people who are out there just by being present. Police are discouraged from misconduct by public scrutiny. It's always been true. It always will be true. The Citizens Police Review Board, which I have castigated and will talk about more on this show, and I will continue to castigate, is nonetheless a place where you can maintain a record of complaints. You can do so by calling them up at 429-3262 or going down to their office at 915 Cedar Street, which is about a block from City Hall. So if you get harassed at City Hall, you can walk to Cedar Street and make a complaint. Unfortunately, you can only do so between 9 and 1 on Monday through Thursday. So not open today, and they're often not open. Most of the time, they're not open. But nonetheless, you can file complaints. They are helpful in filing complaints. Don't expect them to do a lot about those complaints. In essence, it's more of a situation where you can make a public record of those complaints so that possibly somewhere down the road something can be done, and so that the lies of Rotkin and Kennedy, by that I mean the kinds of lies I'm talking about are the inference that more police is needed, when what we need is more control of the police that are present and more facilities and resources for people who have diverse lifestyles who do contribute to the Santa Cruz community. It's a big lie. It's hard to pick out little lies here, but the big lie is real clear coming from Kennedy and Rotkin. And all of Kennedy's Resource Center for Nonviolence credentials cannot disguise the hollowness of his position on these homeless issues. And it's a very sad thing. And I sure hope his friends who are listening to this tell him that. That it's time to resign from the seat he has disgraced at City Council and start doing the kinds of activities that would really reflect credit on what he claims to champion and represent. Nonviolence, Gandhianism, support for the poor, supports for the civil rights of all. If this is a personal attack, then make the most of it. I'm talking about a politician who has almost single-handedly created the anti-homeless downtown ordinances and now wants to put more cops into an area specifically to remove a class of people from that area, in spite of all his protestations to the contrary.
Hi, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Why? When did you start your show?
Oh, the show began at 9:10. I think I...
You didn't inform me.
Oh, I did.
I didn't tune in until just now.
Oh, dear. Well, we missed the first hour.
Great.
Yeah, no, I told you yesterday and the day before that it was starting at 9. And
no, you didn't.
We talked about tapes.
Nope.
Oh, dear. Well, do what you can with it. This is the long-suffering Gloria here, right?
Yep.
All right.
All right.
Keep up the good work.
All right, have a good show.
All right. Bye-bye.
So if anybody else has been recording this show, please give me a call at 423-HUFF. We didn't get to catch the first hour of the show, in which we usually put it on tape and send it north, in which we had a long discussion of the Sentinel article, and we did a brief interview with Tom Osher of Food Not Bombs in San Francisco. We've apparently not got that on tape, so if anybody does have it on tape, it would be much use to us. In the meantime, you got two more hours of Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides, and I hope that you do call in at 427-3772. You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Hi there, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Oh, yeah, Robert, I got some of it on tape.
Oh, good.
Up until about 10 minutes ago, from the beginning.
Oh, excellent.
Okay, you can have it.
Oh, that's great.
This is
John Stewart.
Yeah.
Hey, John, any updates on psychiatric abuses for the audience that might be of interest?
Hold on a minute. Yeah, there's an article in today's San Jose Mercury reviewing the events leading to the comatose condition of Joseph Leitner in Valley Medical Center.
Summarize his case for us.
Well, I'd like to, but not right now. I'm going to do it on my show.
What is that show?
It tells about how Leitner was stuck in this padded cell. They stripped him of his clothes. They subsequently decided he should go from that padded cell in the... this is in Santa Clara County Jail, by the way. They decided he should go from there to the psychiatric ward. They manhandled him, threw him to the ground, tied him to or rather held him face down and wrapped a blanket around his head and manhandled him to the top floor of the building to the psychiatric inner sanctum in the county jail, where they they strapped him to a gurney naked with the blanket still wrapped around his head. They, according to Arnold, did not notice that he was not breathing for some 5 minutes.
They overlooked it. Let's not be too critical.
There was an earlier article on the excusing of the justification for excusing the officers and retaining them, although they got various kinds of suspension for 30 days and 45 days and so forth. The two psychiatric nurses, I believe, were fired. The sheriff's department deputies were not. What essentially is the case here is that a person who has a it should be a warning to everyone to take into consideration such events as this when they want to help their friends who they think are mentally ill. It's problematic whether or not such an event could happen to them. It happens to everyone to some degree or another, whether they're voluntary or involuntary. Sooner or later, there's some kind of confrontation with the system, and you may lose your so-called voluntary status instantly and become involuntary.
John, when is your show?
Wednesday, 10 to noon.
That'll be next week.
Yeah, right. I kind of lost a point that I was trying to make. I forgot what it was.
You were talking about Joseph Leitner, and you were also discussing,
Yeah, I remember what I'm discussing, but I didn't mention what I really wanted to mention is that. There was an article two or three weeks ago about sudden in custody death syndrome.
Yeah.
So called,
like false memory syndrome.
Right. Well, it's more. You have to get the article. I'll review it then also. But it's like people are prone to sudden in custody death syndrome when they've been assaulted and beaten half to death and pepper sprayed and such. If they die under those conditions, sudden in custody death syndrome may in fact be the cause of the person's death, rather than the assault, the pepper spray, and such other events, which is how they excused the deputies in Joseph Leitner's case. They called it sudden in-custody death syndrome. He suffered from that, not from the blanket wrapped around his head, which suffocated him and caused him not to have any oxygen.
Yeah, well,
anyway.
That's a good update, and I expect people will be covering that later on Wednesday at 10.
Yeah, check out the article in today's Mercury, second section.
Yeah.
Okay.
Bye.
Yeah, there's also a number of interesting stories in the Mercury. The front page story talks about Mayor Rotkin's new plan to ban bongos from the mall, or I guess restrict them, which we will be discussing too. In fact, I'm going to do a little playing of the complaints about real crime on the Ford's parking lot, based on a brief interview I did yesterday en route to the Homeless Community Resource Center Board of Directors, which is we had some interesting dialogue with them, and more about that later on the issue of the sleeping ban and the need to change that policy and to get social service providers in Santa Cruz together around that policy. But let's hear a little bit about the Ford's parking lot from the people who actually spend time in the Ford's parking lot rather than peer at the parking lot from their little shops across the street or make statements from their city council seats on high.
One.
Yes.
Arrest this morning.
Yes.
Where a...
Illegal search and seizure. Illegal search and seizure.
Your name is?
Leroy.
Leroy. And how is... You witnessed this illegal search and seizure?
Yes, I did.
And what happened?
I don't know. Well, he was standing there and they grabbed his backpack.
Who's they?
They being the Santa Cruz Police Department.
Do we know the names of any of these fellows who did?
We did not see these officers.
Oh, I see. You heard about them.
We intended to avoid the situation as much as possible.
So you actually didn't see this? We
saw it as we were walking by, and we took a U-turn around so we would avoid the...
So there were two cops and one person in a backpack?
At first there was one policeman, and then after that, two more pulled up.
Yeah, for crowd control.
For crowd control.
Is it with RoboCop's partner?
Officer Perry, and perhaps Officer Over.
Yeah, Perry with...
Overkill and Perry Wary, as we sometimes... Be wary of Perry, as we say.
Anyhow, they proceeded to grab his backpack and open it up, illegal-like. And the children around, they did not appreciate the matter, so they raised their voices.
And what was the ultimate outcome of all this, do you know?
Child being carted away.
So the guy was arrested for what? Do we know the charge?
I believe he wasn't
seeming to hurt anybody. I don't know. He was minding his own business, doing his own thing, enjoying his beautiful, beautiful day that we had. First day of spring, wasn't it? And he didn't want to hurt anybody.
What a morning it was.
What a beautiful morning it was. And what a terrible way to start a good
spring.
About
what time was this?
It's about 11:30. Okay. Morning for us, afternoon for you guys.
Yeah. I would definitely say that it would be psilocybin related, fungus, mushrooms.
So do you think that they discovered the illegal intoxicants, eh?
Well, he discovered those intoxicants by sleuthly ripping the bag off his back and opening it up.
Ripping, meaning forcefully.
I see. Well,
meaning
these officers are certainly forceful individuals.
Yeah.
To say the least.
We just want to enjoy our days. Thank you very much.
Thank you, gentlemen. Do you women have anything to say about this?
Oh, I wasn't there to see it.
And you?
I pulled up and tried to avoid it, but that's totally a negative. I mean, we're just here hanging out, so.
Aren't those flowers pretty?
They are.
Talking to?
First
name on.
Well, my name is...
We'll call you Sig. Who, what?
Space.
Space, what did you see?
I seen motherfucking cops arrest people for no reason.
Like when? When did you see this happen?
Especially in
like
San
this morning.
Francisco. It's even way worse than here.
No, we're talking about Santa Cruz now, though.
Morning.
I just seen a friend of mine get searched for no reason.
Your friend's name?
Huh? Well, that's kind of irrelevant, but...
This is an incident with Officers Perry and Over that happened this morning at 11:30?
No, actually, they weren't even involved.
It was Bailey.
Bailey and Hatcher and somebody else, some sergeant.
When did this happen?
Like early this afternoon or late this morning, whichever way you look at it.
Like an hour ago.
No, it was longer than that.
2 hours ago.
It was early today.
What were the circumstances, and what is your first name? We'll call you Grayhead. Grayhead, what happened for you?
Okay. They walked up to my bro, and they just like the cop like snatched him by his arm and said, "Come here, I want to talk to you." And next thing everybody knows, he's being searched. They grab his bag and they start searching
they
his bag.
Search
him. And
where was this happening?
Right here.
So we're talking about the back lot of the Ford's parking lot.
Right there.
And so they searched this man, and then what happened?
And then they arrested him.
And what was the charge?
Nobody even knows.
Huh? Well, they didn't have no reason to arrest him. They said that he was sitting on somebody's car, and when the cops came up, he wasn't sitting on nobody's car. He was standing there talking to me and some friends.
Okay.
And they said that he.
And we don't know the name of this guy who was arrested.
Not his legal name, no.
Okay. What about his? Do we know the name he was arrested under?
Nope.
Okay. Well, we'll put this on for Radio Santa Cruz, guys.
Huh?
Thank you. Well, it's about 6:15. I'm walking.
Actually, it's about 10:10, and it's Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3. You're tuned to Civil Rights on the Streets with Uncle Robert here. Give a call to 427-3772 if anything that you've heard on the air sparks some interest. And if you have your own story to tell about police abuse downtown, about concerns about the change, or if, in fact, you want to defend what's been read with the statements by Mayor Mike Rotkin and Councilmember Scott Kennedy and various business owners talking about the need to put in more police and remove the scene from Friendship Corner where different people gather. If you have a critical view of what's going on downtown in terms of the poor, let's hear that too. We want to hear from all sides here on the show. What we're going to hear now on tape is an interesting presentation by four people, myself included, at the Homeless Community Resource Center Board of Directors. Now, the Homeless Community Resource Center is the group whose executive director is Karen Gillette, kind of evolved out of the free meal. Eventually it grew to have lockers, and then the meal moved indoors, and there's phone use, and there's showers and so forth, and it's the It's an area down at Coral Street, 115 Coral Street. And by the way, they have an emergency need for blankets. Karen Gillette called me yesterday and asked me to put that out on the air. If you have any blankets and you don't want to give them to the City Hall sleepout for some reason, and I can't imagine why that would be, but bring them down to Karen Gillette and to the Mike Bustos and to the Homeless Community Resource Center, because they can certainly use them there. It's illegal, as you know, in Santa Cruz to cover up with bedding under Section B of the sleeping ban, 6.36.010. And what police have been doing is they've been taking to confiscating people's blankets. I mean, after all, those are pretty dangerous. They could be used again and again to sleep under, and that's impermissible in Santa Cruz. This is not a joke, folks. This is true. It is illegal in Santa Cruz to wrap up with a blanket after 11 o'clock at night. I didn't make it up. It's one of these grim realities. Entering the studio is the long-lost activist who we've been waiting for all these years, the notorious David Dumars. We are going to interrupt the entire progress of this conversation to give David a chance to talk about his case, which is quite related to what we've been doing. But actually, in order to break this up and give David and I a chance to kind of run over things, David is facing new trials and sentencing and nonsense on April 1st, and we're going to be talking about that. David is known to some of you by the briefer and blunter name BD, who's spoken out on the rights, human rights issues locally and internationally in the last 2 years, at least as far as I've been hearing him for the last 2 years, probably longer than that. He used to be known as L.A. Dave in the old days. And we're going to be talking to him at some length. But before we do, I'm going to play a little bit of this Homeless Community Resource Center Board of Directors presentation. Now, what was happening here was that the Homeless Community Resource Center Board was meeting. They meet once a month. I've been trying to get to their meetings repeatedly and been kind of essentially told, well, wait till next time. Karen Gillette has told me this. Our meetings are open, yes, but we want to make sure there's enough time for everybody and so forth and so on. It sounded like I was getting the runaround. Well, this time she did. She told me, we have put aside time for you, put aside 10 minutes. Indeed, they ended up giving us half an hour to come to their meeting, which was held, interestingly enough, in Department 2 in the courthouse. But unfortunately, I came away with a negative impression of the whole process, because their meetings are closed meetings, and they aren't publicly announced, and they're supposedly on behalf of homeless people, and I saw one homeless person on a board of 7 or 8 people. Good man named Mike, but the whole process is too closed for my taste. I'm going to play you some of the discussion, the proposals we brought to the board, and you can judge for yourself. And after that, again, we're going to be talking directly to David Dumars, BD, and you'll be able to call in and talk to David about his case and offer him support. And this is a very important case coming up, and I encourage you to stay tuned.
Token Tim Rinker to the Homeless Community Resource Center's Board of Directors meeting. Tim, you're a man who works during the day and avoids the police at night, right?
As best I can, although lately I've been laying out for them, ready to come,
uh-huh.
armed with my sleeping bag.
I see. And, of course, your good name. So why are you going to this Homeless Community Resource Center board meeting today?
Oh, you just corralled me into it.
Aha! The truth is out. This is another Norse production, eh?
Yeah, well, you know, we have to do something now about the camping ban. And seems like it's just another step.
Okay. We were approached at the meeting as we walked into it and told we had to wait outside. Strange. I thought these things were open to the public, but apparently not. Hi, everybody. So you're the executive board of the board?
At an emergency shelter in the Lackland.
Okay.
Shelter.
I'm sorry. My name is Robert Norse, and I work for a group called HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, with the rights of people. You know, this makes it illegal to sleep outside or cover up with bedding in Santa Cruz after 11 o'clock at night. The main reason that I wanted to address you all was because I was encouraged by what Mayor Brown at least said he was going to be doing in San Francisco. You may have been following this in the paper, those of you who read the Chronicle. He has made a statement repeatedly that he will not arrest people for sleeping in San Francisco outside. He will arrest you if you are drinking. He will arrest you if you are
camping in the sense you have a tent up, but not for sleeping, per se. And I talked to you, Karen, about this earlier, and I think I got the sense that you tended to support this as a kind of a humane alternative, and I thought perhaps the board might be interested in putting forth the same position, because as you all know, we are in a crisis. The winter shelter is closed down, and there's no legal alternatives for people to sleep. And the City Council's Open Air Shelter Subcommittee, in spite of diligent searching, has found nothing other than this. I guess they're trying to support the voucher program by Barbara Riverwoman and Sherry Carnival, but that will help, what, 60 people at most. My suggestion is if San Francisco can...
You're listening to my presentation to the Homeless Community Resource Center Board of Directors from 2 days ago. The presentation was followed by that of Celine Marie Pascal, then Tim Rinker, who you heard talking with me outside the Homeless Community Resource Board, and finally by video journalist Becky Johnson. I apologize for the quality of the tape that has me and Celine Marie Pascal, who's a writer, a nationally published writer on homeless activity, and also recently, or I should say locally, published in La Gazette. I'm very much concerned with the oppression of poor people in Santa Cruz. I apologize for the quality of the tape because it was on voice activated, and that unfortunately tends to drop to zilch when your voice drops. But you'll get the general gist of what went on, and a lot of very pertinent things were said. We continue with this Homeless Community Resource Center board meeting and our attempt to get the board to recommend to City Council that there be a moratorium on sections A and B of the sleeping ban. Those sections of the ban which concern covering up with bedding and falling asleep, just as Willie Brown supposedly has done in San Francisco.
This. Decriminalize sleeping. And there is, of course, some question as to whether the police are following that policy, but if the mayor at least can make a statement to that effect, certainly liberal Santa Cruz could do something similar. Perhaps not even as sweeping. Perhaps Santa Cruz, you could ask the mayor to simply declare that in non-residential areas, if people fall asleep and they're not blocking businesses or blocking sidewalks or creating a disturbance or a nuisance, that they be left alone. During the pendency of the emergency shelter crisis, which was, as you probably know, declared initially in 1990 and then strengthened in November of 1995, last year. So that really was what I wanted to bring to you, and I'm going to shut up shortly so these folks can talk. I want to point out that Visalia, California, decriminalized sleeping in the parks in 1992. Miami has decriminalized sleeping under a federal court order. Santa Barbara decriminalized sleeping from 1986 to 1989 when a judge reinstituted it simply because he was that kind of a judge, not because of any particular problem. What you hear most frequently from Mayor Rotkin and other people who don't like this idea is everyone will come to Santa Cruz to go to sleep. Somehow the idea that there's luxury accommodations to be able to fall asleep on the streets, I don't find it very persuasive. And the history of where it has been decriminalized, I think, does not support that argument. Also, in Santa Barbara in 1986, it was because of significant pressure from service providers as well as homeless activists on the streets that there was a change in the law. And that's what I'm suggesting you consider. The problem with asking for simply a change in policy, which Karen and I suggested, is that you'll get a complaint from the police chief and the city council that that's selective enforcement and they can't change their policy. What's needed is a temporary suspension of sections A and B of the camping ban. A states, if you fall asleep, it's illegal. B states, if you cover up with bedding, it's illegal. This leaves in place other sections in the camping ban which, for instance, forbid an encampment. And if that's a concern that people are going to set up tents, that section could still be used by the police. But if your board, I feel, like service providers in Santa Barbara, comes out strongly for a humane alternative, I think that we can get the fourth vote. There are three votes on the city council already that favor modifying or reforming the camping ban: Byers, Scott, and Kennedy. Either Matthews, Yokoyama, or Rotkin could provide that fourth vote, and I think that they would listen very seriously, certainly more seriously than to me, for that. And I suggest that there should be certain areas in the city, probably non-residential areas, where if people fall asleep and they're not blocking traffic, not blocking the sidewalk, after 11 o'clock at night, that they should not be arrested under the sleeping ban. Unless there's some other problem, like a public safety problem or a drunkenness problem or a littering problem.
So you're not suggesting that you should stop, like someone who doesn't lay down in a doorway on the street when they're
sleeping
alone, but if they find them under the bushes along the river levee.
Right. Exactly. The police department will tell you that they're already doing this, that they don't ticket people, but my information is that people are getting tickets anyway. I was at court yesterday with a man who got a ticket. He was sleeping downtown with the permission of a store owner who said he could sleep near his store. And the police nonetheless confiscated his property and gave him a ticket for sleeping. So there is certainly contradictions in the stories that you're getting from the police department from.
Oh, yeah, Elm does the same thing. And it's, I wouldn't say campsite, it's called a dome village, where there are structures that homeless people can come and stay for 6 months or a year. They have.
This is the voice of Celine Marie Pascal, the writer. And we join her in mid-statement again because her initial statement was so low in tone that the recorder didn't pick it up. But she's talking about Los Angeles and what alternatives they've used down there in terms of a dome city. And she speaks quite clearly about that.
It's an inexpensive way of enabling people to develop stability, community, and self-sufficiency. And I think that, you know, advocating for something along those lines. People here talk about a campground, but I think this is a little bit more substantial than a campground. In addition to not prosecuting at this time for sleeping, seems like a really humane way to go. And I have here two articles that I've written for national magazines and a presentation that I gave to City Hall. And I wanted to offer them to you not because I think they're going to give you more information than you already have about homelessness, but because I think they might place the information you have in both the historical and national context that might help. It's yours. So I really appreciate your making the time to hear us out. And I guess that, you know, I'm really here because I think the need for leadership is paramount. And we haven't been able to turn to City Hall to, you know, to entrust that leadership solely to them, that the people who are homeless really need advocates such as yourselves at a time like this. So thanks a lot.
Hi, I'm Tim Rinker. I volunteer with Food Not Bombs. I also work here in Santa Cruz through a temp agency. I've been homeless since October. I've also been off and on the past few years, but this latest time has been since October. I was hoping it wouldn't last this long, because when I did become homeless, I did have money to move into another place. It's just that I couldn't find it, and I couldn't afford the place I was moving out of, and I was hoping to find something cheap. I was staying with a friend for a while, for a few months, and that was working out pretty well, I thought, until their landlord threatened to evict them for a number of reasons, but one of them being that they didn't like the homeless people staying there. There were a couple of people other than myself also staying there. So then I was staying at the Armory, which was okay. It wasn't the best situation, since I was working a job up at the university till 4:30, and then it's, you know, I only have till 6 or 6:30 maybe to get up to the Armory. And then I was starting a job on, I just started another job up at the university on the 14th. And I think I'm a pretty good person to, you know, show how this camping ban really affects people. Because I'm not, you know, one of the homeless people that's, you know, just has no more hope and is going to be homeless for the rest of their life. I'm struggling. I'm trying to get myself out of debt. And I have money. I've saved up money so that I can move into a place. It's just I've been holding out because I've wanted to find something cheap, and it's hard to find something good and cheap in this town. I think that the camping ban is makes the situation even harder. You already have a stigma of being homeless, and even if people don't even realize that you are homeless, I feel it at times. You know, I don't know. It's just this thing. I mean, I don't even like people to know that I'm homeless sometimes. As it turns out, just last week I found out that I did get a room to rent over on Seabright. However, I can't move in until April 1st, and It's the landlord wants to take it back as of January, so it's only for this year. I'm happy to have found it, and I'm glad to have moved in there. But I'm still in this 2 week span where it's like, oh, what am I going to do? You know, I have this job up at the university, and you know, I don't want to move into a motel because that's just going to drain my savings. And you know, I feel like I could go out and play their game, you know, hide, basically. But I think that's it's not right. You know, there's hundreds of people out there, and for us to have to hide from them is ridiculous. You know, pretend we're not there. So I've been joining the camp out at City Hall. I've gotten two tickets so far. One of them was last night. And I haven't been arrested yet because I've avoided getting two of them within a 48-hour period. But, you know, a few of us are just committed to fighting this thing until it falls down. We'll take it to court, and I'll go to jail if I have to. Because I don't want to be in this same situation next January. And, you know, it's this idea that people are just going to camp anywhere. That's not true. I mean, I don't want to camp on Pacific Avenue. I don't want to sleep on the sidewalk. I don't want to sleep out in front of City Hall. It's not comfortable out there. you know, people want to be left alone, so they'll go out and find a private spot for the most part. Anyway, and I just wanted to say again about the Willie Brown over Christmas. My aunt, she's a Republican politician, and she was asking me how I liked my new mayor, and she meant Willie Brown, and I said, oh, Mike Racton, and I said, well, yeah, I like Willie Brown. He's better than the you know, Mayor Jordan with the Matrix program. And I also had to say, though, our mayor, Mike Racton, is a professor of Marxism up at the university, but he still enforces the camping ban. He doesn't think people should be allowed to sleep outside at night. And, you know, I just think it makes common sense. You know, even from your position, I mean, I think it would be in your best interest to get rid of the camping ban, because you're serving the homeless people. And, you know, with this change, I heard over the weekend that someone was telling me, oh, yeah, they're not going to allow us into the lockers after 5:30, and I found out since that's not true. But at first I thought, oh, this is stupid, because this is overreacting, and it's just going to piss people off. And, you know, if you really want to help people, just let us sleep. I mean, just let us... I think it's just an absurd law, and, you know, something has to be done. You know, I'm not really asking for a campground because I can find a place, you know. I'm not so concerned about that. Some people, that's their focus. And I think, you know, that's reasonable if they have, like, a certain spot. And that was the excuse before when they had the open-air shelter. You know, you can go there. And anything would be better than what we have now.
Hi, my name is Becky Johnson, and I've been covering homeless issues as a video journalist, and I'm also a member of the Citizens Committee for the Homeless, or at least I think I am, but I won't get into that here and now. One thing that I'd like to add on to something that was said earlier, I interviewed a police officer at about 3 o'clock in the morning, and he told me a lot about his feelings and his experience with the camping ban law. And I asked him how many tickets he wrote on a given shift. And he says, oh, I generally write 3 or 4 camping ban tickets a night. And so I don't know how many police officers are on duty in a given night, but you multiply 3 or 4 times how many officers on the shift. That's a lot of tickets being written each and every night. This does affect homeless people very adversely. Another thing is that they're being written tickets as an infraction, if they get two infractions within a 48-hour period, then that's an automatic misdemeanor. Now, the way misdemeanor works is if you're charged with a misdemeanor, then the police have the right to put you in handcuffs, to take you into custody, to seize your possessions, to take you down to the jail, to book you, to hold you, those sorts of things that they would not be allowed to do if it were an infraction. People are being arrested. They're putting like up to, we've heard reports up to 13 people in a holding cell that is 10 feet by 10 feet. There are two small benches in the room that are designed to seat three or four people comfortably, maximum. The rest of the people either have to stand or sit on the floor. Various people have described it as being very filthy in there. There's garbage on the floor, dirt. It's rarely cleaned. And there have been cases where people who, especially like heroin addicts who are arrested, will vomit, and then the vomit is left uncleaned up for several hours. We have heard reports of people being released at 4 o'clock in the morning after having their bedding and their rain gear seized. And I heard one man who told me that he begged them not to release him at that time and that hour because it was cold outside and he was not prepared for the elements. And they just pushed him out the door. The bedding and rain gear is being seized and kept as evidence. Now this is like a sleeping bag is an evidence of a sleeping crime, the crime of sleeping. Things like putting cardboard on the ground below them is considered sign of bedding, and corrugated cardboard does provide a lot of insulation and comfort versus concrete. It's a big difference. But homeless people are being harassed by the police for that act. And then there's this pattern of these charges, these misdemeanor arrests, which the police have allowed themselves to take people into custody and put them through this humiliating and brutalizing experience, are each and every case being reduced to an infraction later on. When the person is released, it's an infraction. Because of that policy, people are being denied their right to legal counsel, and they have been denied their right to a jury trial. So since 1985, when these laws have been effected in Santa Cruz, City of Santa Cruz, it has never been tested by a jury trial. I put forth to you that these are abuses of human rights and that it is unduly punitive to homeless people. Now that we have the campground at Pearl Street has closed down and the armory is closing down or has closed down, we are in a situation where we have an increasing number of homeless people. I personally believe that we need a campground very greatly at this point in time to have a legal and a designated place that we can have managed hopefully well, and that would be a great resource and fairly low cost in the sum total, certainly less cost than putting people in jail. Yeah, the cost of $20,000 to $30,000 per year per inmate. We could put them up in a luxury hotel, and they wouldn't be homeless. So I urge your committee to put forth the thought in the mind of the city council that they at least pass a moratorium on the camping ban law until a new open-air shelter is established. Thank you.
Do you want to say anything?
I just want to say one more thing. I appreciate your giving us additional time.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. When you're in a position of service providers who are funded by the city, I realize it puts you in a difficult position if you are criticizing or suggesting significant reform in the policies of the city. And I have often, in my attacks on the city council for not moving on this issue in the last 8 years, I've sometimes included Karen to some extent and other people with the Homeless Community Resource Center because I felt they could have done more. And I do appreciate your actually considering this issue. I think it's really important that you not be co-opted here.
In San Francisco, Mayor Jordan used the facade of social services to do 30,000 arrests of homeless people. And in Santa Cruz, even though you have a mayor who professes to be liberal and a city council that is 6-1 progressive, you have what is unarguably the worst anti-homeless law in the state. This is the only area of California that I know of, and I've worked in three different regions as a homeless advocate, which makes it illegal to sleep on most private property, the exception being a backyard or a fenced-in side yard. You can't park your van in a driveway and sleep have your mom or dad or your visiting relative sleep in that vehicle and be free from the threat of a ticket. This is the only area that I know that does this. And the mayor's statements that we have the best social services and so forth and so on are not relevant, really, to the basic issue that there is no legal place for the overwhelming majority of homeless people to sleep, and that these policies are oppressive. And they oppress the people that I know you want to represent. That's why you're spending your time there. That's why you're here tonight. That's why you're doing this. So I think that it's really, and you have a significant impact on this council. They want you, in essence, to endorse their policies. And when you don't endorse their policies, even though that creates friction between you, may even threaten your funding,
we're in the process of the discussion of what we can do around this issue.
Would you prefer to be in a closed meeting on this now, then?
Well, our meeting's over. So we're just going to set up. What will probably happen from here is we'll go to the program subcommittee, which is the group of the board that discusses sort of program issues and more. I mean, I'll be at the council meeting Tuesday.
Yeah, you're all invited to the council meeting on Tuesday. I mean, it's not on the agenda. I guess the vouchers are on the agenda. What do we know what's on the agenda?
Some people say it is, some say it isn't. I don't know yet. If it is on the agenda, we'll be there. Or at least I'll be there.
Okay, and we intend to invite people to speak at the open mic, and of course, that's available to everybody. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Hey, Hopeless, what's the story? Here we are meeting in the hallway afterward.
No, I don't think so. Very good. I think that we made a strong presentation, and I think this is one of the best things you've organized that I've been part of.
All right.
I think that there is hope for this.
All right. Well, knowing this bunch of people, actually I don't know them, but I hope you're right.
They look like humans anyway.
They do.
They look like...
So does the city council.
they look like they have a biological need for sleep.
Talking to...
Maria.
And we are back live in the studio with live and sniffling BD, a.k.a. David Dumars. Belly up to the mic there, BD, and say hi.
Howdy.
And, boy, it's been at least 2 years and more since I first met you. I guess you first came to prominence. Are you around for a while? I mean, how long have you been in Santa Cruz?
8 years.
8 years. And how long, do you remember how long you've known me?
I first met you, I think, about 1990.
Really?
Yeah.
That far back. I remember meeting you most recently, when really things became intense, was in 1994. Robert Flory and Dave Jacobs began two vigils, one of 2 weeks over Christmas, and then one of 1 week around Valentine's Day of 1994 on the Mall. This was at the time when the lower courts in Southern California had ruled that sleeping was not illegal. In fact, that arresting people for sleeping was itself a violation of U.S. Constitution, the Eighth Amendment's protection against cruel and unusual punishment, the right to travel, and the right, I believe, to due process, or maybe equal protection of the laws. In any case, there was really a lot of optimism that the Santa Cruz ban, which was worse than the Santa Ana ban, would itself be found unconstitutional. And activist Robert Flory, who is now part of the Sleep Out at City Hall, and wanton Dave Jacobs, who hasn't been around for a while, set up a kind of a cardboard box on the sidewalk downtown in front of a fence, which was part of the area that had not yet been rebuilt after the earthquake, and then set up a table during the day and talked about sleep crime and the rights of homeless people and essentially set up a peace vigil, two peace vigils. The response of the merchants to that was rage, the response of the Sentinel was slander, and the response of the city council was the downtown ordinances eventually, which they, I guess, proposed in February and passed in April, laws making it illegal for people to sit down on the sidewalk, later modified by court order to sit down 10 feet from a shop. That was actually, courts threw out the more sweeping law, and Kennedy and Rotkin rushed back in with a substitute law in the summer. In any case, other laws were all passed, and all this sort of began, was fueled by these two vigils, as well as, of course, the police-provoked riot on New Year's Eve, 1994, where bungled management by the police department and the attempt to clear people from the town clock at 10 after 12 enraged people, and when the police attempts to shove and baton people away and break up the drumming circle resulted in a riot downtown. You got involved in this, I guess, because you were supporting the Valentine's Day, or I should say Valentine's week-long vigil, which was actually located in what is now in front of what is now the Cinema 9, and was then a fence.
Well, I got involved because it wasn't just the vigil that I support. Nor is it simply the sleeping ban that I oppose. In general, specifically concerning the issue of homelessness, I mean it's an open sore. It's not just in Santa Cruz. It's, you know, across the country and stuff. And it's a very, very glaring expose about what really goes on in this country. Now, specifically on the day that we're talking about and the situation that we're talking about, I got involved because I was at the Food Not Bombs feed, and various individuals who were supporting the vigil came over and said that there was a heightened police presence, that they certainly did not want this protest on Pacific Garden Mall, and at that point they were planning on making some fairly decisive moves to remove it.
Let me ask you about this protest. How many people were involved, and was it blocking the sidewalk and creating a tumult? I mean, what was the nature of the protest?
The individuals involved, I think people around Food Not Bombs certainly, and certainly Wonton Dave, are professed nonviolent activists.
Are you a nonviolent activist, BD?
I don't hold the same philosophies as these people, but nevertheless, the point is that they are, and it's reflected in their approach to protest and whatnot, which is not confrontational. I mean, that's real. That's really not true. Rob Flory, Wonton Dave, Kim Argula, Food Not Bombs in general, and all the kinds of the other people that are around it is. Their tendency is to be not confrontational. And what I mean by that is they don't go up and they don't get in people's faces and they don't try to provoke a fight with the cops or any of that sort of stuff. They do try to confront what they see as being unjust, which is a very, very valuable thing to do.
Now, what were they doing on the day that you happened to involve yourself in the particular manner that resulted in this long chain of police activity and court appearances that we are now, actually, is coming to a head on April 1st when you go back to court?
They had a kind of a protest array of boxes and a table and signs and different things set up. And they were spending the night there, and they had as sharp expose of what was going on as they could arrayed on this utensils for, you know, for people who do not, shall we have a lot of money to protest the conditions under which people are forced to live. They were doing that. They were sitting on the sidewalk. They were sitting on cardboard on the sidewalk. They were sitting on whatever they could sit on because it was a nice day. And
were they blocking the sidewalk?
No, actually they weren't. They didn't tend to do that sort of thing. They were just, you know, hanging around. And they were being cited, threatened with arrest, harassed, and intimidated by quite an array, an impressive array of police force.
How many cops do you remember being there?
Well, it went up and down. They would come by and they would issue warnings, and then they would drive away. What was distinctive about the thing, though, is that here you had Rob Flory and Wonton Dave and the other individuals who were involved, who were being harassed and cited and for various legal infractions, and people right across the street, well-dressed kinds of folks, shoppers, families visiting Santa Cruz, enjoying the sun, were not being cited, certainly not being harassed for the very, very same activity.
Sitting on the sidewalk.
Sitting on the sidewalk, sitting on the planters, sitting on the curb, mm-hmm. hanging around. Mm-hmm. They were not being cited. And that was pretty glaring. And that's what was going on. So I decided to take it across the street. I walked across the street and I started walking towards the bookshop Santa Cruz from the vigil. And as I walked up the street, I would stop and I would talk to people. You know, you are doing something that the police consider to be illegal, although you certainly are not going to be stopped, ticketed, cited, or harassed by the police for doing what. But right across the street, the homeless and the protesters and whatnot are. And so I proceeded to get into conversations with a variety of people. Some people were sympathetic, some people didn't want to hear it. And I walked towards the bookshop Santa Cruz. At the bookshop Santa Cruz, there was kind of this perfect situation. It was like a lot of people out drinking coffee and latte and having, you know, brunch and whatnot.
Is it Georgiana's Cafe?
Yeah, yeah. And right in front of this grouping of people sitting around tables and chairs, there's this concrete cover of some sort of city mechanical apparatus.
It's a square kind of cement box, which I believe has since been topped with a metal ridge that makes it difficult to sit on or stand on in order to discourage perhaps the kind of use that you put it to.
Possibly. So I hopped up on this this concrete box, or whatever you want to call it, and started to do some street agitation to the congregated shoppers and diners and coffee drinkers. And some people didn't like it. One person way in the back threatened to kick my butt. Some people found it kind of interesting, but it certainly drew a lot of attention. I decided to jump down off the box for two reasons. One is, as I finished my street agitation, I was just going to walk away. The other is that if some yahoo in the back gets really upset and wants to start something, a physical confrontation, it would probably not be the most advantageous position to stay up on the box in this possibility.
Again, I remind our audience that where this was right in front of Georgiana's Cafe, next to the bookshop Santa Cruz, right next to the flower stand on downtown Pacific Avenue. The site of what had been a homeless table there for the last 3 months in the day when Jack Light John Hamilton, who's known to our Free Radio Santa Cruz audiences as Johnny Dredd, had been signing up people for an opposition to the sleeping ban. And this, of course, so enraged Neil Coonerty, owner of the bookshop and then on the city council, that he passed a special law making it illegal to set up a table in front of a sidewalk cafe, as it is now. It is illegal. It's also illegal to perform in front of a sidewalk cafe, although you will often see people performing because it becomes a matter of selective enforcement and the cafe owners can make those choices who they're going to harass. But go ahead with your story.
So, sort of out of nowhere, I didn't see him coming, this guy runs up and tells me I can't do it and proceeds to grab me.
Can't do what?
Can't do sidewalk agitation. Cannot speak out. Certainly cannot speak out. I suspect had it been President Clinton, he probably would not have reacted the same way.
Or Scott Kennedy.
Or possibly not Scott Kennedy. But he was very emphatic, not telling me that I couldn't do what I was doing. Threatened to beat me up, made all kinds of pretentious threats, and actually grabbed me.
Now, who was this doughty man?
As it turns out, it was a gentleman by the name of Stuart Martin, the person that runs the establishment across the street, the Intergrand Design.
The ID building.
Mm-hmm.
Or the ID.
And I continued my street agitation, and when I got done, I walked away from Stuart Martin and went down and rejoined this peace vigil.
Which was across the street, located at the Cinema 9, or what is now the Cinema 9, was then a hole in the ground and a fence.
Right. It was back across the street and down the street towards, towards the other end of Pacific Garden Mall, probably 50 yards or something to that effect.
Mm-hmm. Half a block.
Yeah. Shortly, two cops walk up with Stuart Martin and say, "You're under arrest." And I say, "What for?" And they say, "Battery on this man here, Stuart Martin."
Mm-hmm.
And I step forward and I say, "Well, not only now is it illegal to be poor and homeless in the city of Santa Cruz, it is now illegal to protest." The treatment of the... I was immediately grabbed, thrown down on the sidewalk, a wrestling match ensued. The cops grab me by the hair, pull my head back, and immediately proceeded to spray pepper gas in both eyes from roughly 6 inches.
The man who did this was whom?
Sergeant Alufi.
Goofy Alufi. Bill Alufi of the Santa Cruz Police Force?
Yeah.
Same man who was driving cars into crowds during the Iraqi war demonstrations?
He was, I believe, the command personnel on the scene. He was the person who was in charge of all the various police activities that were going on directed at the peace vigil. And the other individual who was involved in it was this guy. His name's Medina. I couldn't see. I couldn't open my eyes. It was a rather unique sensation. Excruciating pain. I was hauled to the police, to the jail, and I was denied medical care. I demanded to see a doctor. They said, "You don't need to see a doctor," and they threw me in an individual cell at that point. Just let me lay on the concrete.
Had you been afforded an opportunity to wash out your eyes?
No, there was no medical care provided. There was no water, there was nothing.
We're talking pepper gas. In fact, pepper gas has recently appeared in the papers in some accidents that have happened. You may have noticed as you've been following the papers, I think a teacher, some pepper gas exploded in her purse, and they had to have 20 people went to the hospital in order to for checkups as a consequence of this.
The following day, in the Sentinel, in the report of the incident, it was reported that Officer Medina went to the hospital because he had caught some of the back spray of this pepper gas.
Really?
Yeah. That was on page 2 of the Santa Cruz Sentinel on the following day.
All these incidents happened in February of 1994, folks. You're on the air listening to David Dumars, who goes back to court on police and merchant concocted, I should say also DA concocted nonsense, stemming from these incidents in February 1994, where David Dumars, or BD, was defending the rights of the homeless to survive, and as well as the rights of the public to publicize these conditions to the community. You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. Phone number to call in if you have comments or questions is 427-3772. Go ahead, David.
This has been going on for quite a while, and the whole incident resulted in 6 misdemeanors.
Now, you want to go into what happened the next day, or is that...
Yeah, but I wanted to make a comment on what you were saying in terms of the charges being concocted.
Right.
And it is my position, and I think that if you really look at the case and sort of leave, shall we say, preconceived notions apart or aside, then you have to really ponder the collusion between the police, the DA, and the courts and the courts themselves. Judge Barton is an active agent in this. The municipal court judge is an active agent in this. He's not a shall we say, impartial observer or an impartial judge or anything like that.
Judge Barton is a municipal court judge whom I call Barracuda Barton for his notorious behavior in okaying a search warrant in the case of Alan Brady, arrested 3 or 4 years ago for hemp seed, which he was using for protein food, openly acquired, openly processed. But Brady's house was raided. He was dragged out of his house. His possessions were seized, and he was dragged through it. I guess it was at least a 1 year, maybe a 2 year court battle, where Barton rubber stamped the search warrant on his house, even though there was no basis for doing so. But anyway, before we go into the collusion between the courts, the DA, possibly the merchants, and the police, maybe we should do is understand kind of chronologically what happened. This happened on the day in February when the police were harassing the peace vigil. Maybe it even was the last day of the peace vigil. I'm not sure. You were jailed.
It wasn't the last day.
What were you charged with on that first day? On that first day.
On the first day, I was charged with battery on Stuart Martin. That charge was dismissed prior to the first trial that I was involved in, prior to the defense's presentation of its case. The prosecution, in the midst of the prosecution's case, came out and said, we probably can't prove battery. And the reason that they did that is because Stuart Martin's contention that I went there, jumped up on the tables, kicked the coffee cups over, you know, chased frightened entrepreneurs and coffee drinkers and whatnot into the counter, you know, into the corners and kicked over chairs and whatnot, was contradicted by all the other witnesses.
There's also a videotape made of subsequent witnesses who had viewed that. And in fact, is it not your contention, BD, that, and I call you BD, and I always call you David, one of the two, I'll call you BD, that the real assailant was not you at all, but in fact was that great man, Stuart Martin, from the ID building.
Stuart Martin has a history, actually, a long history. Many of the people that listen to the radio station know of it. The one thing that came to our attention in the midst of this legal confrontation in the court and in the midst of the trial and whatnot is that my defense lawyer, the public defender John Thornton, was contacted by the lawyer of another gentleman. He was a retired military colonel.
Reggie Keskow.
Yeah. And he was picking up trash in the back of the ID building and just happened to dump it into the dumpster in the back, and he was attacked by Stuart Martin. He subsequently had a heart attack.
So Stuart Martin is... This was all, of course, recorded in a lengthy flyer, the unwanted Stuart Martin poster, which we began distributing in front of the ID building about 8 or 9 months later when we had a vigil there to protest anti-homeless attitudes downtown and anti-homeless laws in Santa Cruz. In any case, battery was the charge against you. That charge was dismissed, but the next day, further complications arose. And what were those complications?
Well, I wear glasses, and I went down to pick up my glasses. The cops had sent them careening across the sidewalk, and my friends at the peace vigil said, well, we got your glasses. You can come down and get them. So I went down, and I got them. And the police showed up again, and I said, well, it's time to take a walk, because I did not want this thing to reoccur. I walked down the sidewalk and into the Santa Cruz Coffee Roasting Company. A very, very short period of time later, maybe in terms of a few minutes, maybe only in a few seconds, who knows, I can't remember exactly, cop car pulls up in front and a cop car pulls up down the hallway way in the back.
You were surrounded.
I was surrounded.
But there was no helicopter overhead anyway.
Oh, I can't testify to that. I was inside the building. So I'm standing there in line getting ready to order a cup of coffee, and in walks Sergeant Upton, the resident expert on pepper gas in the Santa Cruz Police Department, according to the Santa Cruz Police Department and Sean Upton. Mm-hmm. He walks in and he walks up to my coat and he says, you're going with me now, you're going with me quietly now, or we're going to mace you just like we did yesterday. He had a canister of pepper gas, not more than about 6 inches from my eyes, and I ducked. Mm-hmm. What I mean specifically is I buried my my face in my coat sleeve, so they couldn't spray me. Mm-hmm. They did release the gas; it was all over the jacket. Mm-hmm. And as it turns out on the trial, not only did they spray me, but they sprayed two of their witnesses, employees of the Parks and Recreation here in Santa Cruz. The cops had walked in prior to this event occurring and said, you better stay out of the way. They had known each other. They knew each other from working the same beat. Mm-hmm. You better stay away. Something's going to happen. Mm-hmm. So they were at a table several feet back. Somewhere, the testimony is anywhere from 10 to 15 back, feet back, and they were sprayed by Sean Upton's burst of pepper spray. Another individual who was a witness for me in the defense, a carpenter who lives in La Selva Beach, an individual I had never seen before, had to leave the coffee roasting company because of the pepper gas, and testified as to exactly what occurred. They walked up, sprayed me with the pepper gas, threw me on the floor, and the same sort of melee occurred as the day before. I was subsequently arrested. Prosecutors asked for a $1 million bond. The judge reduced it, suggesting that $28,000 was a satisfactory bond, probably keep me in jail for a while. And
how long were you in jail under that bond?
I was only in jail for a matter of days. As it turns out, what occurred was is that we go back to Judge Barton. Mm-hmm. We went in to see Judge Barton, and he said, okay, we'll let you go on your own recognizance. It was an OR bond. He said, on the other hand, you cannot go on the Pacific Garden Mall. Mm. So what he did was he said, we'll release you as long as you do not set foot on the Pacific Garden Mall from Water Street to Cathcart.
So in other words, they were trying to exclude you from the area from supporting the peace vigil and other protests against the oppression of the homeless that were happening downtown. At least that would be my analysis.
My analysis of the situation is, again, if you think about this, there's collusion. Now, you said there's collusion with the downtown sort of business merchants, some of whom are fairly substantial, some of whom are just small businessmen, mm-hmm. or businesswomen, depending upon. And I think that's included in it, but I think more significantly is the collusion between the police, the courts, the DA, and certainly the political authorities, the elected political authorities, i.e. Mike Rotkin.
It was Mayor Scott Kennedy at that time.
Scott Kennedy, Neil Coonerty. And that, if anything, the police and these other political authorities use kind of the fastidious and ingrained prejudice that people learn to rationalize and to okay the kinds of attacks that come down on the homeless or any other impoverished, marginalized section of the population, youth, black youth, immigrants, etc., teenage women, you know.
Let me ask you this. When the sergeant approached you with the pepper gas in the coffee roasting company, what was he charging you with on the second encounter? Did he specify that, or did he just say you were under arrest? And if he did or didn't, what eventually did you learn you were charged with?
He didn't specify at the time. As it turns out, I was charged with two things. I was charged with criminal vandalism, i.e., writing on the side of a newspaper dispenser, newspaper stand, the Sentinel in particular, the words in blue magic marker, "The New World Order has a Third Reich odor," and also a swastika with a big stop sign over the top of it. In terms of these other charges, the other charge that I was that I accrued in this collection was disturbing the peace. Apparently, for some individuals, standing in line for coffee is disturbing the peace.
So you were accused you were given two charges on this. You were given one charge initially the day before, battery.
No, I was given three charges the day before.
What were the three charges on the first encounter at the Georgiana's Cafe Bookshop, Santa Cruz?
The second charge was trespass, that I had actually gone on Bookshop Santa Cruz property. That also was dismissed in the course of the trial, prior to the defense putting forward its case, because there was no evidence that I had gone on anything other than a sidewalk. Aside from,
which, as we know, is Neil Coonerty's property in that particular section of town, thanks to the new Coonerty Cafe law. But at the time, in February of 94, there was no such law.
Well, you might look at it from this standpoint. For the likes of Neil Coonerty and these kinds of individuals, possibly they think the whole town is their property.
Well, Sergeant Hennig and perhaps even Sergeant Seeley, though actually I think it's only Hennig I've heard say, "Get off of my mall," was one of his most famous statements to homeless activists in the early 90s. But okay, so you were charged with trespass. You were charged with battery against Stuart Martin, trespass against Neil Coonerty, and what was the third charge that you were charged with that justified the pepper gassing of you for protesting the dismantling of the peace vigil, the harassing of the peace vigil across the street?
Resisting arrest.
So then you were charged with resisting arrest. Now, so there were three charges on the first day, and on the second day in the Coffee Roasting Company, you were charged with disturbing the peace, criminal vandalism, and was there anything else?
Resisting arrest.
Resisting arrest. One of the old favorites, which actually members of the new sleepout at City Hall have also been charged with. I believe Dan Hopkins was charged with resisting arrest. We're talking Dan Mega Mello Hopkins, the man who has trouble raising his voice above a whisper. This is a guy who defers to anybody he talks to. He is so humble in what he does, even though he did challenge the Citizens Committee for the Homeless. The man is resisting arrest. I think we have to say it's one of those charges that looks good on the booking sheet and pumps up the cases from infractions to misdemeanors. But proceed with your case. I will cease my interruptions for the moment.
Resisting arrest is also an important charge as far as the police are concerned. The resisting arrest sends a message from the police to the prosecution, to the judge, that this is a case that we want prosecuted. This is a case that we want jail time on. That's the significance of that particular charge. In the subsequent protests in the spring of 1994, when people sat down to protest the anti-sitting law, a variety of the people that were arrested for sitting down were also charged with resisting arrest.
Among them, Candlelight Kim Argula, a Food Not Bombs activist who received a full-scale jury trial about a year later. The jury acquitted her, the jury foreman shook her hand, and the DA who prosecuted her case is now, one of the lead people who is due to take over our DA Art Danner's seat once he is either impeached, resigns, or who knows what he does next. In any case, that's Lyons, DA Lyons. In any case, yeah, resisting arrest was used against numerous sit-down people in the demonstrations in 1994 and against you, apparently, 2 months before those laws were even in effect.
So what occurred is it was taken to trial. In the trial, the trespass and the battery charges were dismissed. They cannot come back. Mm-hmm. I was acquitted on resisting arrest the second day. The jury said that they felt that I had basically been set up.
This is in the resisting arrest charge in the Coffee Roasting Company, where you were surrounded by police officers, intimidated with the pepper gas. Were you told of the charges against you in the Coffee Roasting Company?
No.
And you were, in essence, put into a position where you felt you had to protect yourself from being pepper gas? Was that the idea?
That's the idea. I didn't prevent the spraying of the pepper gas. What I did prevent it was from being sprayed directly into my eyes.
Once in 48 hours was enough. In 24 hours.
Once in 24 hours was sufficient. I was convicted of resisting arrest on the first day. I was convicted of resisting an arrest that the judge had already determined had no basis. And to...
Can you clarify that for me?
Okay. Resisting arrest is kind of the generic term for a specific law that says you cannot interfere with a police officer in the performance of in the lawful performance of its duty. Basically, if you are being arrested or somebody else is being arrested and a cop has a reason to do it, you can't stop it. That's kind of the gist of it. But the law is also quite clear in the fact that a police officer has to have a reason to arrest somebody. Now, this is the way the law reads. This is not, in fact, reality on the street. And the difference is between my case and a wide array of other cases is there are all kinds of economic constraints. There's all kinds of, we'll make a deal with you now. We won't prosecute your case. You can get out of jail. If you plead guilty, you get probation, blah, 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 blah. All this sort of stuff goes on. And the law is usually not even examined. The courts don't examine it. The prosecutor, even the public defenders, don't even look at it because all the other kinds of facts surrounding the circumstances in which people are caught up lead them to kind of take the short course, which is get the hell out of here as quick as I can, which is not something that I would blame people for, but the point is that a cop, according to the law, has two reasons or two ways that he can arrest you. One is he saw you commit a crime. Or two is he has a warrant for your arrest. He cannot simply presume or think or hear that you committed some crime in some sort of vague way. In my particular arrest, Stuart Martin came up, said, I want to make a citizen's arrest. I saw this person do this, this, and this. He battered me. Mm-hmm. At that particular time, the cops heard from a variety of individuals saying that was not the case. There were a variety of witnesses that ran up to the police and said Stuart Martin was not battered, he was in fact the one who did the battering. There was no trespass. So what the judge did to get a conviction is he said, well, a cop really doesn't have to do these things. He can just think that you commit. He can be operating on good faith. Now, I understand that's a contradiction of terms.
He used a similar kind of argument in okaying the search warrant of Alan Brady's house. But that's another matter.
That also is a contradiction of terms, a cop operating in good faith. And so he gave incorrect jury instructions to the jury. Cops can just arrest people if they're acting on good faith, if they're presuming, say, oh yeah, I honestly believe that what I was doing was okay.
Well, if it's good enough for Newt Gingrich, why isn't it good enough for Judge Barton?
That case, that conviction was vacated for that reason.
By what judge?
By the appellate judge in Superior Court here in Santa Cruz.
Stevens.
Mm-hmm. The second charge that was vacated that I was found guilty on was disturbing the peace. Disturbing the peace is a crime that somebody has to see you and complain that you actually did it, mm-hmm. right? You can't just say, well, you made loud sounds, you were disturbing the peace. Mm-hmm. Stuart Martin complained that I battered him, but on neither of those 2 days did the police get any complaint that I was disturbing their peace, whatever the hell I was doing. Whether or not I was
disturbing the police is what you were doing.
Whether or not I was kicking over tables or not, the point is that nobody made those complaints except for Stuart Martin. And he complained that I had battered him.
Mm. Batter, believe it.
Yeah. Mm. So that was vacated. The convictions were vacated. The last conviction of criminal vandalism, writing on the side of a newspaper stand, is something that we're still embroiled in. And the reason is because the particular law, as it reads, certainly anti-graffiti laws were not wiped out, and they're not going to be wiped out, that's for sure. But in this particular case, the law was rewritten prior to my arrest, and I was convicted on the law that had been repealed.
Was the law that had been repealed a stronger law or a weaker law? Had the law gotten worse or better by the time you went to court?
It got worse. It actually got worse.
I actually think there's been a recent decision on graffiti, for example, in terms of chalking. Chalking on the sidewalk is no longer considered graffiti activity. Witness our chalking around City Hall, stop the sleeping ban, and so forth. So I don't know. Was this an erasable marker that you used, or that you claimed to have been used by you at the on the newspaper rack that they said you were convicted of using?
Whether or not it was erasable, I don't know. I can't answer that question. I can answer this question, and that is, you know, as far as I'm concerned, when you do graffiti, do it permanently. I'm not backing off on this graffiti shit whatsoever.
I see.
And the reason is that people out there should be infuriated that a whole generation of youth are being criminalized for artistic expression, for tagging, or whatever it is. Frankly, when a youth sprays on the side of a freeway embankment, smash, bang, crash, where car after car after car piles up and they do some fairly sophisticated art, and then the authorities turn around and make this activity illegal, you know, we have a difference of agreement, specifically vis-a-vis this charge. This is what I want to address, because one of the reasons that Barton gave me rather extraordinary sentence is because basically he figured I lied in court.
Now, what was the sentence he gave you? And well, I understand it was never shown that graffiti, which was on the, they never actually investigated whether it was permanently on the box or not, right? Didn't they?
Well, the actual conditions of it are two. One is on the morning in question, everything was covered with dew, right? And so was the box. I'll tell you that. As to whether it was actually permanent, I don't know.
Uh-huh.
I'd bet money that it wasn't. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless,
but there was no showing of evidence that this box had been permanently damaged.
No, the person that actually made the complaint, who was a Sentinel employee, imagine, who sat, you know, some 50 or 60 yards away, suggesting that I had written all over this box, took the box and returned it to the Sentinel without even investigating as to whether or not, you know, you could wipe it off with your finger or not. You know, that wasn't even a question. The question was, here's a box, it's got something on it, this is the guy we want, get him. And that's what occurred.
So how long did your trial take?
It took 3 days.
And how much would you estimate it cost the state?
Well, I don't know. I'm not what you call a good budget analyst.
$10,000 or $20,000, maybe. I don't know. That's what a 3 or 4 or 5 day trial costs. Who was your public defender?
His guy by the name of John Thornton.
And how did he do?
Well, I would suggest that John Thornton as a public defender is as good as you can get.
Which is not very good, or pretty good, or outstanding, or
nothing. I have a dim view of lawyers in general. I would prefer to approach it from this position. Is that John Thornton has a certain sensitivity to these kinds of issues, which inclines him to pursue these kinds of cases to the degree that he's actually capable of doing. The flip side of the coin is public defenders are officers of the court, and it has a limiting effect on what they're willing or even capable of pursuing. So it's kind of a contradictory sort of situation. I would suggest one of the things that John Thornton suggested that I put in the appeal is the incompetency of counsel. And I would absolutely argue that he did not perform incompetently, nor particularly badly. I think that he pursued it to the degree that he could.
Why did he make that suggestion?
Well, it's kind of a standard appeal issue, the competency of your trial lawyer.
And perhaps it goes to the fact that the very nature of the public defender defense which where public defenders are more interested in maintaining good relations with the district attorneys than they are with doing the will of their clients and serving their best interests, such has been my experience in this court system, that they're perhaps ipso facto incompetent. But I think I like John Thornton as a person. I've talked to him. However, he was utterly incompetent in a case where I brought him into court to testify to abuse by a bailiff in a courtroom where I was arrested improperly, held improperly, and then I sued the bailiff for the charges that resulted. I had to pay an attorney, and so I charged him for attorney's fees. Now, much of the time actually was donated by the attorney, but I think she should have been paid. In any case, Thornton gave a completely tangled account. He was incompetent as a witness, and he's a good man. He's a good man as a human being, but I think that there is an intrinsic conflict between public defenders. Maybe it's because you call them officers of the court. I call them. They have an arrogant attorney-like attitude. They're all attorneys, of course. They don't want to. They're overworked, and they use that as an excuse to dehumanize and distance themselves from their clients. Trying to do a political defense with a public defender is almost an impossibility. Any case, you were found guilty of vandalism. The law had changed, and the law had become worse, and you were apparently been convicted under the old law. So you challenged that, or you're still challenging that? What's happening in the current situation with that conviction?
Well, they vacated all of the sentences, and one of the reasons they vacated all the sentences is because I got 180 days. The sentence that I got was 90 days back-to-back, not to be served concurrently, but 90 days consecutively.
90 days for?
For criminal vandalism and 90 days for resisting arrest.
And then the disturbing the peace charge was the sentence suspended or something?
No. The comment that the judge made, Barton made in the court was, I'm not going to sentence you anything for disturbing the peace because I don't believe that it occurred.
So disturbing the peace and resisting arrest, one of which he was sentenced for, were eventually thrown out because of bad jury instructions?
Right.
And the only thing left was criminal vandalism for 90 days?
Correct.
And yet, here you are. Now, you had thought that this was all resolved, or the sentencing hearing was put off until April 1st. And then what have you learned lately?
Okay. What occurred was is that we went into the appellate court, okay? The brief that we got, again, from a public defender, and I don't really want to pursue that particular avenue.